Good morning. As details pour in about a fatal police shooting last night in Charlotte, North Carolina, we'll ask Ken Lawson, co-director of the Hawaii Innocence Project, about police criteria for the use of deadly force. And National Voter Registration Day is in its fifth year, a nationwide nonpartisan volunteer effort to get out the vote. It's next Tuesday, and organizer Marsha Rose Joyner is with us. I'm Chris Vandergrift.
I'm Bill Sage. Onepaa on the mainland, Pua Case discusses Native Hawaiian standing with indigenous cultures in North Dakota and California. And becoming a farmer on the Valley Isle, Phyllis Robinson will tell us about the Farm Apprentice Mentoring Program.
On Wednesday, September 21st, the conversation will start right after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook, sitting here with my partner, Bill Sage. Good morning, William.
Good morning, Chris. It seems like it's a beautiful day in many respects, but looks like there's a lot of room for improvement, huh?
Some clouds on the horizon. Yeah, the fatal shooting of a black man last night in Charlotte, North Carolina, and another of a clearly unarmed black man Friday in Tulsa, Oklahoma, have brought the issue to the fore once again. What are police criteria for the use of deadly force? Are they consistent? Are officers properly trained? Ken Lawson is a former criminal attorney who teaches criminal procedure and criminal law at UH, and we're asking him to weigh in. Good morning, Ken.
Hey, good morning, Chris. Good morning, Bill.
This is a scenario we've obviously seen replayed way too many times, and frequently it begins with a traffic stop.
Absolutely, yeah. As you know, Chris, you not speak off air often. You know, I did these types of cases. I represented many family members who had black men killed in the city of Cincinnati that erupted in riots in 2001, similar to what we saw in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right. It normally starts off as almost an encounter on a traffic stop or some type of street stop, you know, walk and talk stop. And then it just escalates until where deadly force is being used, you know. And what we see, at least what, you know, I think what the community gets tired of is the excuses that come afterwards, mm-hmm. you know, and from my experience, you know, a lot of officers, right after the shooting, instead of telling exactly what happened, that something, I had one officer who shot my client and killed him, who basically said to a supervisor immediately afterwards, "I can't tell you what happened. My gun went off," you know, and he mm-hmm. got afraid. Right after he met with his union attorney, then it came back. Oh, the guy was going for something in his pants. Mm-hmm. And my point in that is that there's a lot of mistrust in the community because a lot of officers, instead of being allowed to freely say, "I made a mistake. Mm-hmm. This was an accident. I shouldn't have shot. I was afraid." And looking back on it, I wasn't justified in my fear. They're prevented from saying that immediately out the box.
Yeah. When you see police departments portrayed in popular culture, it's very much on the side of this close ranks after just about everything, that you do not, under any circumstances, betray a fellow officer. You get your story straight, you're consistent, and it's sort of our police department right or wrong. Is an attitude that's promulgated in popular media. We are sort of being trained to accept that.
That's a good point, Chris. And not only accept that, but you hear, let's look at the situation in Tulsa. Everybody sees that the individual's arms is up. He's in a position of surrender, at least letting officers know, even though they're saying he wasn't obeying their commands, mm-hmm. he's still letting them know, "I'm not a threat to you. That's the reason why my hands are in a position of surrender."
Yeah.
And so then afterwards, the excuses come up. Well, he should have just obeyed the command. He should have stood right there. He should, you know, as if that's a reason to justify the use of deadly force. And keep in mind, an officer's right to use deadly force is no greater than yours or mine. Mm-hmm. Now, they don't have a duty to retreat because they're police officers. But if somebody came at you, the only time you could use deadly force is if you reasonably believe that the person is going to cause you great bodily harm or death. so you must have an honest and reasonable belief that you're in danger of great bodily harm or death before you can resort to deadly force. It's the same for police.
There's all kinds of forces between, you know, before deadly force. And in the New York City I grew up in, if you sort of made a move on a police officer, chances are you might get a nightstick upside your head.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, in under today's climate, I guess my question is, would you be more likely to be supported using your weapon than smacking somebody in the head and knocking them unconscious?
I think under today's climate, you'd be damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Yeah.
Right? But I think the point is, at least what I get from you, is that it seems to me that now police are more likely to shoot. And a lot of shootings are just based on an implicit fear, mm-hmm. right? Not really seeing what they believe that they saw. I mean, again, the Oklahoma example, or Tulsa is a good example. A few months ago, I don't know if you remember this or not, but in Florida, there was a man who was trying to get custody of a mentally impaired individual. And the mentally impaired individual was sitting in the street, and the officer shot the man who was the worker. I don't know if you remember this or not. Didn't kill him. Mm-hmm. But the man was in a position to surrender, and telling the individual, maybe a teenager, but he was mentally impaired.
Yeah.
But the officer shot the mentally impaired child, but then still tried to make an excuse for why he shot the gun. So a lot of it has to do with an implicit fear. I don't think a lot of the officers are getting up out of bed and I intentionally want to go kill a black person.
No, of course not. And you are in an extreme, you know, anything can happen in a traffic stop. And if you are a police officer, you're going to be going into situations, if you're properly trained, you are at minimum trained to expect the unexpected in an encounter with somebody who might, even over a minor incident. I'm sort of trying to understand this from the police officer's point of view.
And that's the purpose for the taser, though.
So
we saw three officers, at least three officers on the scene at this crime, right, react in three different ways.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. One used a taser, one didn't shoot, and one killed a man.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But they're all observing the same situation. So it goes back to what you were saying earlier. Is there a need for national training?
Is it consistent across the board?
One, it's not consistent, right? And two, there is a need. Again, a lot of these individuals, our community is still divided in many parts of our country. So the only time that you get to see a Latino, the only time that some of these officers get to see a black is when they're at work pulling them over,
mm-hmm.
right? Because at night they go home to their neighborhoods, the blacks and Latinos go home to their neighborhoods,
it's
and we're forever separated.
Yeah.
And so the only thing that we know about each other is what we see on TV and the fear that's been generated through our own stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
And until more community problem policing is done, like it's been done in Dallas and other, and even in New York.
Mm-hmm.
When community-oriented problem policing is done, it brings the police and the community together to work together, not just on crime, but to get to know each other better.
Yeah.
As you stated in New York, man, you had beat cops that walked down. They knew who you
see
were.
See them every day.
And they tell you, if you don't stop doing this, I'm going to tell your father when he or she gets
right. That's right. Exactly.
That's the type of community problem-oriented policing we need to get back to, because then when they pull Chris over, they know who you are, right? So the fear is not there as much as we see now.
Yeah. And yet it seems to escalate, and in spite of so many things that could be construed as progress, we do seem to be getting further and further apart in the cities.
We do, and again, I think what we have seen that has worked, though, you talk about national training,
right.
is a move from certain police departments to do the community-oriented policing, where they're actually out there. And so even on their off time, they spend time in the communities,
mm-hmm.
right? They go to little carnivals. They do things. They volunteer in the community. Right, and they become part of that community. And we have seen a drop in shootings in those communities.
Where does the attitude to institute that kind of policy come from?
From the chief of police, from the mayor, and actually a lot of it's generated through lawsuits and sometimes the Department of Justice coming in doing an investigation and determining that there's a huge problem in the use of force and the lack of standards and training in a particular community.
The Tulsa mayor was very forthcoming in a radio interview I heard a little bit earlier today about, he said, no, this is, the guy had his hands up. I'm not justifying this. He was really pretty much disavowing his police department. And you have to wonder, in city by city, are there these disconnects?
Because the police unions are powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, the police unions are extremely powerful.
You saw that firsthand.
Yeah. And so when a mayor or a politician goes against a police union, mm-hmm. Because the police, you can see it here, no matter what type of use of force or allegation of abuse of force happens here, you see the police union takes an ironclad stance. The officer did nothing wrong.
Circle the wagons.
Yeah, circle the wagons. It's a lot of it takes guts for a politician to say, you know, I'm looking at this, and this doesn't look right with respect to how the police officer conducted themselves in Tulsa.
Something's got to change, Ken. This situation's getting ready to pop.
Right. And often things got to, you know, some things have to be broken in order for them to get fixed, right? And the sad part of it is people say, well, you know, protest peacefully. But it's been in only those cities where we've seen a lot of hell being raised where there's been change.
Yeah. We'll be talking about this more. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Appreciate it. Ken Lawson is co-director of the Hawaii Innocence Project. He's an associate faculty specialist at the William S. Richardson Law School, teaching criminal procedure, criminal law, professional responsibility, evidence, and the business of law practice. As an attorney in private practice in Ohio, he was lead counsel in more than 100 criminal trials, litigated numerous civil rights and police misconduct cases.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HBR2. It's 8:15 and coming up, Onipa'a. But first, Malama na Manu in the backyard.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau.
In today's backyard quiz, it's an all-too-familiar story. A native species treated, threatened with extinction. This one is a red honeycreeper that lives on Kauai, Maui, and Hawaii Island, whose numbers have declined to an alarming degree in recent years. The reasons for the population decline are familiar. Habitat loss, the spread of avian malaria, aggravated by the loss of forests to the disease known as rapid ochia death. The bird's population continues to dwindle, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service believes their numbers have dramatically declined even since the last census, proposing that they be listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The bird we're thinking about this morning is one of more than 50 species of honeycreepers believed to have evolved from a single species that lived in these islands millions of years ago. We're looking for its Hawaiian and English names, and we'll be back with them in a half hour. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Aloha, I'm Angie Lepret from Hawaii Kai. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
When Liliuokalani was imprisoned, her motto became Onipa'a, stand together. More than a century later, many native Hawaiians still practice this principle, not only for Hawaiian sovereignty, but in solidarity with Native American nations on the mainland. In North Dakota, the Lakota protest against another oil pipeline, and in California, the Winnemem-Wintu struggle to preserve water rights for their salmon and just to be recognized. Pua Case is with the Winnemem-Wintu in California, and she joins us by phone this morning. Aloha, Pua.
Aloha.
So the case of the Winnemem-Wintu, it's almost unbelievable from the background I've read. Here, there were people 100 years ago, there were more than 14,000. Today, there's fewer than 200.
Yes.
And what exactly happened to sort of get them, it seems like they had most of their rights and treaties removed almost without due process. and yet they endure somehow. And so you were there to join them in their solidarity struggle?
Well, I'm going to start by saying that I'm standing in a circle with the Winnemem Wintu right now, and they're a tribe that are now about 120-some in number.
Uh-huh.
And they are one of the few tribes, if not the only tribe, that is actively trying to bring back the salmon to the McLeod River, but also very active in wanting a seat at the table when it comes to the water rights that have to do with the rivers that they live on and their life ways depend upon. So we're here today with them at the Bureau of Reclamation, and we're doing a direct action as a part of a two-week journey that we've committed to, and that two-week journey is called Run for Salmon. And Run for Salmon is a prayer that we've committed to make for 2 weeks that starts at the Segorite in Vallejo and ends up the McLeod River. And the salmon that they're fighting for to bring back is in New Zealand right now, in Aotearoa, in the place of our relatives where they were sent many years ago.
Just to survive because the endangerment, big agriculture is taking the water from the river and diverting it?
Yes, they are.
I understand.
So it comes to this, you know, when the Winnemem have to come here on these sidewalks and hold their signs and stand and say, we need to be talked to. We know our salmon best. We know the waterways, and they're not given a voice because they're not federally recognized.
And
so
yet,
Havani and I are here to represent really many, many others who stand with them in the islands, from the islands, and just we know what it's like to not have a voice at a table. So when I heard you say Onipa'a earlier, that this is about standing strong, even when you stand alone, and you're almost basically standing alone here. And it has to do with the water, and people aren't aware of it, aren't realizing it, aren't stepping up and speaking up, but they are.
This is one of the facts about the way that electronic media, ironically, without electronic media, which is, of course, a Western development, none of this would have been known. And yet it can be used perhaps to bring the awareness that something that's definitely heva, it's wrong.
Yes. Alliances have been made on social media that are binding,
uh-huh,
that are fully committing. And these alliances really, as you might know, I call it sacred Facebook, because this is where I meet those people who are doing great things, those who are standing far beyond, doing what more than I could maybe ever think of doing, and I stand with them. And that's how we become stronger. And we form these alliances, yes, through social media. And then we have opportunities to meet in person, which leads me to a standing rock.
I also would like to ask, it seems to me almost incomprehensible that Governor Brown and Senator Feinstein, who are generally champions of people and individuals' rights, that they're proposing to raise the Shasta Dam by another 18 feet and build these water tunnels that would divert so much. Are they aware of the problems the Winnemem Wintu face?
They are very much aware of them, although the chief, Kalim Sis, informed us last night that she's not had a sit-down with the senator, although they have made numerous requests, being affected directly by the raising of the Shasta Dam. But it's not just about her people, and that's what I really want to say about what she's standing for. Water is everyone's issue.
Right.
But yet the Winnemem Wintu and their supporters have made an agreement that they have to stand because in their creation story, the salmon gave them their voice. The salmon had the ability to speak and gave it to the Winnemem and said, because we give you our voice, you must speak for us always. And I find that fascinating with all Native people who have creation stories that have morals in them on how we should conduct ourselves or our pathway and guide us on that life way. They really believe that.
It's their Kumulipo.
And so they have committed to the salmon and the water, and that's why they're standing. And yes, the legislature, the government, it's like many other places. They're not inviting them to the table. They're not listening to them. And I believe it's because perhaps they're not recognized and they're low in numbers. However, like we always say, this is for everyone. Water is for everyone. And if you don't think so, just don't drink it for a number of days. And then find out how precious it is, and maybe it'll move you to make a stand with them.
Perhaps it will. I wish we had a lot more time. We're down to less than a minute. But have there been more reactions from the general public at large because of their stand?
Well, because of this two-week journey, we're getting more coverage. People are finding out. We have a concert tonight that's going to bring much more awareness. Nako Bear from Medicine for the People is hosting it. My daughter Havani is performing, as well as many others. And I think we're going to start to have to work together more and bring our own contacts and bring our own nations and our people and our relatives into whatever we do. So if we only have a minute left, I just also want to say that we went to Standing Rock. There are other Hawaiians there who went before us and who are still there. And the reason we went there is because those relatives stood for us.
That is
when
great.
We were on Mauna Kea and we were holding that front line, they prayed for us. They came over and stood with us. And now it's our turn. And that's about water, too.
That
and is. So is Mauna Kea.
All right.
It's
well,
about water. Just the aquifer under the ground. It's the rain that falls and what it will touch when it falls on the mountain. It's all about water.
It is indeed. And Pua, I thank you so much for being with us and sharing your mana'o for us.
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak today. And love and light to everyone out there, Mauna Kea, Ohana, and all our relatives who are standing strong. Keep standing for water, for what is right for the earth. For the earth itself, for each other and our life ways, we send you our aloha from here. We represent ourselves in a good way, and I thank you. So mahalo, mahalo.
Ai, mahalo, aloha. Native Hawaiian educator, cultural practitioner, chanter, dancer, and petitioner Pua Case is with the Winamam Wintu, the people in California. For more information, see our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
HBR sustaining members are the beating heart of this station. They know their monthly gifts mean a steady, predictable income, and that the station could not survive without them. Sustainers are a big part of the reason HBR can come to you daily, so please take the health and well-being of HBR seriously. Pledge $10 a month to keep your public radio station strong. If you can keep HBR coming to you every day, you can call us at 955-8821 to become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org. City prosecutors are bound by federal law to disclose all the evidence they've gathered in criminal cases with opposing counsel to ensure a fair trial. But a local criminal defense attorney says the Honolulu Department of the Prosecuting Attorney routinely hides information about police misconduct. He's taking his case to the state Supreme Court. And reporter Chad Blair has more in this morning's Civil Beat Reality Check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris.
This is being filed by an attorney who has numerous cases that involve police in one way or another, right?
Right. His name is Richard Holcomb, by the way, and he specializes in DUI cases. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right, as you reported at the top. He's talking about a ruling back in 1963 from the U.S. Supreme Court. It's called the Brady ruling. And yes, prosecutors are supposed to turn over any evidence that cast any doubt on a defendant's guilt. But he's saying that not only is the prosecutor's office not doing that, but perhaps intentionally has implemented a policy to keep it that way and to even destroy evidence that might implicate a police officer. Now, remember, this is all in the guise of this unusual law that we have here in the state of Hawaii, and that police misconduct laws, rather police misconduct, is not something that the public or the media can get a hold of. It's protected by state law.
And yet, in the case of your clients being arrested, if the arresting officer has any kind of a misconduct in his or her history, you obviously want to know that to defend your client, and you have a legal right to be told about that.
Exactly. So imagine if you're an attorney like Mr. Holcomb and you're defending someone who's got a DUI, and you find out that the police officer that arrested your client actually has his own problems, his own background. Maybe he was lying about things. Maybe he covered up evidence. Maybe he has some involvement himself in past DUI cases. Therefore, does that cast some doubt on the accuracy, the truthfulness of the officer? And could that affect whether your client is set free or not? He calls this really a real-world consequence of government secrecy. You're talking about wrongfully convicting someone, or on the other hand, you could even be setting violent felons free.
Well, Chad, what is it that the state Supreme Court is empowered to do? What is he asking? What is he asking of them?
Well, he has submitted a petition, and he's asking to have the court take action to require that the prosecuting attorneys actually comply with the federal law, to actually impose changes to make police misconduct records more accessible, at least to defense attorneys who have a real interest in trying to find out whether their client might be compromised. So this is the question that is before the high court. By the way, Keith Kaneshiro, the city prosecutor, who, by the way, is also up for re-election this year, he couldn't comment specifically on Richard Holcomb's petition. He did say that in no way does his office try and purposefully withhold evidence. There is some concern on the part of prosecutors that this Brady Law implementation could be used to settle scores or even ruin the careers of police officers. So that is a concern from their point of view.
You would think that compliance with a federal law would not require a petition.
You would think that would be the case. In fact, there's what's known as a Brady list, which is, again, right named after the law, the ruling, to make evident whenever there's a problem in a courtroom involving a police officer and their history. We do not have such a Brady list here in Hawaii, even though it does exist in many other places across the country. So we'll see whether the high court decides to have the city prosecutor's office follow the law.
Well, it'll be this is one to follow for sure. Thanks very much, Chad.
Thanks, Chris.
And every day we bring you a reality check with Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair. You're back with The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook at 8:35. Americans are notorious for taking their voting rights for granted, to the point of neglecting to do it when so much is at stake. National Voter Registration Day is an effort to get you to the polling place, regardless of how you plan to vote once you get there, and perhaps along the way to reflect on what a privilege it is. National Voter Registration Day is September 27th. Marsha Rose Joyner is part of the Hawaii effort to get it underway, and she's with us in our studio. And Marsha, I referred to registration as a privilege for some very good reasons, as you know.
It is a privilege, and for most people, if we go back to the early days of our country, the first, when our country was founded, only white male landowners
yep.
could vote.
Yep.
And then when Jackson came along, he was behind in the polls, so he decided that ordinary white males could vote.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, we got in 1917, we finally got women, and 1965, black people. So this whole idea is evolved to today where everybody over 18 can vote and should vote. You have a voice. This is your government. And anybody that doesn't if you don't vote, your neighbor gets to say what's going to happen.
And, you know, Lord Marshall, we spend our lives trying to have some control over our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And almost all Americans, by our very nature, hate the idea of having power taken away from us. That's our founding
yes.
principle, right? So how does that fit? You see what I'm saying?
Well, you know, my first, I remember, and it's probably not my first, but the time I remember this was many years ago before computers. I called a senator in my district, called his office, and asked for something. Mm-hmm. And he says, just a minute. I'll be right back. And then he came back to the phone, and he said, I noticed that you didn't vote for me. He checked his records. I hadn't donated to him. I didn't vote for him. And it was when I was real, so that's the way. So I have no voice with him.
Usually they wouldn't come out and say that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I learned then. I said, okay, so I have to really be in the game. You know, if you don't vote, you can't grumble, right? If even though I did vote, but not for him, I voted for his opponent.
Yeah.
But the point is, since that time, you have to make it clear that you vote and your vote counts. Even if it's the opposition, it counts. And if you look at the primary, do you know how many blank votes won?
Yeah, yeah.
People that left it blank, you know, you can't have the blank votes outweigh.
Well, then you have sort of the rule of apathy.
Yes.
Then if that happens. And
but if you took the time to vote and then left it blank.
Yeah.
But anyway, we want people to register September 27,
next Tuesday.
Now, you can register at any time, but Tuesdays nationwide is an effort to get people to register. Now, there'll be lots of places in Honolulu to register, places statewide. Number one, the Waikiki Community Center, and then out in Waianae, which has been behind in voter registration.
Yeah.
The address is 85761 Farrington Highway, and there will be, from 10 to 3 p.m., there will be people sitting out in the shoppings in the parking lot waiting for people to come to register to vote. The Waikiki Community Center, as well as other places.
Marshall.
But the big thing is you can register online on your smartphone. We will leave the link with the station. You with your smartphone, you can register online.
It's almost inevitable that people who register, however they register, will say, it's a lot easier than I thought it was
yes,
going to be.
So
why do people think it is more difficult than it really is?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a very simple process. All you need is your name and your last four of your Social Security. You don't have to put the whole thing in.
Right. Well, that gets to something that I was thinking about, you know. We've seen all kinds of reasons for people to be concerned about loss of privacy.
Right.
And we now know that government is not immune from
oh, yes.
invading our privacy. And I wonder if people might use that as a justification for not registering.
Well, if you get your driver's license, you can register at exactly that same time.
Uh-huh.
And you give them more information for your driver's license than you do for voter registration.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's an accurate perception, but
right.
I just wonder if it is out there.
Have you ever, well, it's been a long time, of course, but if you apply for a license to get married, they have everything on there, including almost to your blood type.
Yeah.
How many times have you been married? Why were you divorced?
Right.
You know, so
right.
you give away a lot more information than you do to register to vote.
It's pretty minimal, but we are now seeing, I just want to get back into the whole sense of what a privilege it is by putting it in a historical
yes.
context. You and I are both quite fond of doing that. And, of course, we've seen whatever they call them, voter fraud laws being proposed in states around the country that remind a lot of people of the Jim Crow laws. And I'm hoping that Americans remember what those Jim Crow laws were.
The Jim Crow laws came into being after the Civil War.
Right.
And this is because I'm a historian. There was this thing called the Electoral College.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there was a tie in the Electoral College. And there were federal troops in the South, incidentally, after the war, federal troops in the South. And so President Hayes says, well, look, he promised the South, we'll take out the federal troops if you give me your electoral votes. And they did. So out came the federal troops, and in came, well, we can't legally segregate, we can't do what we used to do, but we can create these, quote, Jim Crow laws, which put up a barrier to so many things.
You would essentially have to take a test.
Yes.
And if you were black, that test was made much more difficult.
Oh, they'd ask you to repeat the Constitution.
Exactly.
And there were poll taxes. You'd have to pay mm-hmm. to vote. Mm-hmm. And to ask you to, you know, something in the Constitution.
Word for word.
Word for word.
Name
yeah.
all the signers. It was ridiculous.
Yes. It was ridiculous. And then, you didn't pass. What do you? And then you go home and you memorize and you come back. Oh, you still didn't pass. You left out a comma. You know?
Marcia, it essentially comes to just getting people to understand that this is a hard-won privilege.
It is. And when you look at not just Jim Crow, but the women that went to jail for the right to vote. And it was only... Now, Hawaii was before the nation in the right to vote.
We have to run, but I mean, we all carry a lot of weight going into this thing.
Yes.
And need to be aware of it. Thank you so much.
Well, thank
it's
you.
It's September 27th, next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday.
Marcia Rose Joyner is a longtime civil rights activist and one of the coordinators of National Voter Registration Day. September 27th, next Tuesday. Keep a look at our website at Hawaii Conversation. We'll tell you how to get there. Thanks, Marcia.
Thank you.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that
wanted to help. Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. The arts are just frivolous activities. Teachers have been fed this inaccurate myth for years. As chair of the Board of Trustees of the Honolulu Museum of Art, Vi Liu is in a position to do something about it. When I was young, she said, my family was very giving. Later, through the Hawaii Community Foundation, she and her husband, Paul, made many grants. Today, she's giving to the future, for she is a driving force behind the arts-based curriculum, where art is used to teach non-frivolous subjects. For example, origami is a great way to teach trigonometry, because, she says, studying art opens your eyes to everything. The museum's course, Plastic Fantastic, teaches many things with one subject, plastic. They study environmental issues, ecology, the scientific method, and plastic's impact on the global culture. That's quite a lot to get from studying one simple everyday material. As Vi says, art adds another dimension to our perspective of life. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Aloha, I'm Melissa Chang, also Melissa808 on Twitter. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HIConversation.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozaya. Good morning, Bert.
Hey, Bill, you know, I got to get Melissa to do a little promo for us, too.
Okay. And the promo might be about, say you're doing an entrepreneurial startup when you're a tech. What do you do?
Well, you know, one of the challenges that I think the startup community is always going to be faced with is that, you know, even if there are initiatives like the accelerators, Accelerate UH, and Blue Startups, where, you know, money is actually being invested in those companies, ultimately you want to see those companies survive, succeed, thrive, you know, grow. But the question that we're going to be asking is Hawaii big enough for that to actually happen? And we're seeing a lot of companies have to make the decision on whether or not they need to shift their focus and perhaps consider, you know, moving to the mainland. So we're going to be exploring that and see what kinds of decisions are having to be made to you know, come to grips with that reality.
Just because good ideas are good ideas doesn't mean you don't need actual product, and shipping can be expensive.
That's true. So that's tonight.
All right. Bite Marks Cafe at 5 p.m. Thanks so much.
Sure thing.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about an endangered native forest bird whose numbers have declined dramatically in recent years. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed they be listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. One of the major threats to survival? Avian malaria, which kills 95% of affected birds. Well, our bird has bright red feathers, a pink curved bill, black wings and tail. Its bill is perfect for sipping flower nectar, and you can see it in places like Kokei State Park on Kauai, Volcanoes National Park on the Big Island. Its distinctive red feathers were used by Hawaiians for feather cloaks and helmets back in the days when these birds were abundant. Its Latin name, Drepanis coccinea, but we know it as the iivi, the red honey creeper. It's 8:48. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Mention Maui to most people, they think Haleakala, Hana, Lahaina, tourism. But agriculture is a major part of life in the Valley Isle, and you can't have agriculture without farmers. So you want to become a farmer on Maui? Where do you start? Land is pretty expensive in Paradise. Well, why not become an apprentice? That's what FAM is all about. FAM stands for Farm Apprentice Mentoring. And Phyllis Robinson manages it on Maui. She joins us by phone this morning. Aloha, Phyllis.
Good morning. How are you, Bill?
Well, I might be too old to start as a farmer, but
never too late.
Never too late. Well, there's some dirt out there in a little flower pot, and it's not huge in acreage. But so you're a young person, I imagine, or maybe somebody in their 20s or 30s. Is there an age limit for learning to be a farm apprentice?
Not necessarily, but it does take quite a bit of physical endurance to farm. And I think that we need a new generation of farmers. The average age of farmers in the nation, and also that's true in Hawaii, is about 61. So it is really important, I think, to grow a new generation of farmers, especially since we have all this wonderful farmland opening up here on Maui.
That's one of the things people, they seem to forget. Maui is, what, 700-plus square miles, and there's quite a lot in the isthmus that used to be sugarcane, and now it's just open acreage, mostly staying zoned for agriculture?
That's right. 27,000 acres of the Hawaii commercial and sugar land, which is actually owned by Alexander and Baldwin, is designated as important ag land, and it will stay in agriculture. And, of course, it's a moving target about whether it's going to be grazing land or biofuels. But what we're rooting for at the Hawaii Farmers Union is that it actually is used to grow food. And we would like to be able to work with HCNS, particularly with all those farmers that are getting laid off, to perhaps have them join in on our Farm Apprentice Mentoring Program, which is getting started quite soon now. And as you will probably say at the end of the broadcast, we have a big event tonight. So,
now, the one thing I've noticed from several sources, before Western contact, they estimate the entire island populations back then was over 400,000, nearly 500,000 people subsisting at a, quote, Stone Age level, and yet they were completely able to control themselves without famine. How much food with our modern technology and population do you think we can add to sustainability just for the islands themselves?
Well, that's a good question, and it's probably not a good one for me to answer. I know Governor Ige has an agricultural plan, which is to increase our local food production from its current 10%, which is unbelievable that we import 90% of our food in Hawaii. He wants to get it up to 20% by the end of the decade. And so it's a good question. I wish I were the one to answer it, but I'm not sure I can talk about how important it would be for us to clean up that land. Mm-hmm. After 100 years of monocropping sugar, we have a chance to farm more diversely and more sustainably. And that's kind of where our FAM program comes in. We focus on farming organically and teaching those methods to the next generation of farmers for commercial success in the marketplace. And the average growth of the organic food market is about 6 to 8% a year nationally, whereas commercial non-organic is only growing at 1%. So that means that the market is increasingly desiring organic food choices. So our mission with the Hawaii Farmers Union is to teach new farmers how to produce organically at the price point that the consumer can afford for their food preferences. So we really want to be able to have a new generation of farmers that are passionate about growing organically.
Now, if the organic growing, I remember the soil depletion allowance from the agriculture on the mainland. What happens to the lateritic soils in Hawaii when they've been farmed in sugar and pineapple as monocrops for a century? How do you rejuvenate them?
Well, there are a variety of methods, and some of them actually come from Korea. Korean natural farming is an excellent way to rejuvenate soil. It's a fairly complex method, and we've been fortunate to have a couple of their experts, including the founder of Korean natural farming, Master Cho, has been teaching and certifying people in Korean natural farming in Hawaii through the University of Hawaii at Hilo. And so we have a course that we're going to be offering to our farm apprentices in Korean natural farming. And they're cleaning up soil in Korea in massive, massive tracts of land. So we're very excited about having this. And now Master Cho, who's in his 80s, has a son, and his son has actually come over to Maui just this past year, and we're hoping to have the new generation of farmers starting to learn the methods that they use to actually clean up large tracts of land. And it does take injection of microorganisms, because those microorganisms can eat through just about anything. And if they're given a little juice, yay, and that's part of what we're interested in.
The sort of juice they would give. I've heard of the bokashi bucket approach, where you have sort of starter microbes and they just keep on chomping. And microbes are tiny, and you can grow them anywhere.
Microbes are us.
We're being held together by bacteria sometimes.
Exactly.
Now, one thing, I don't want to toot the horn too much, but you mentioned something coming up pretty soon.
Yes.
And that is?
We have an event actually tonight at the University of Hawaii, Maui College. It's at the Laulima Building, room 106, and it is an opportunity for anyone who is wanting to explore farming as a career to come to the college. We're going to feed them with local food, and then we're going to tell them about our Farm Apprentice Mentoring Program, and we're going to actually have them do a self-assessment to see whether or not they're ready to be a farmer. And we'll put all that together, and if it comes out at the end of that event that you feel that you're ready to take the leap and be part of our Farm Apprentice Mentoring Program, then yay.
Yay.
And I want to add that we've had this as an RSVP, and so I think at the end of our broadcast, you're going to give them my contact information.
Will do.
So
and
that,
I wish I could. I wish I could go more.
If people want to come, they can give me a call or email me, because we want to make sure we get we get
Thank
your
you.
Information
Thank
and
you so
we
much,
can
Phyllis.
Give that number to our
All
food
right.
people, because it's really important.
We will. We'll do that. And I want to thank you so much for being on. Phyllis Robinson, the program manager for the Hawaii Farmers Union for the Apprentice Mentoring Program on Maui. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for more details.
Bill, it's kind of refreshing to see farming described as a wave of the future.
I hope it is, because younger farmers, and maybe we could finally get to one race, the human race.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Oh, yeah.
That's it for today. But up tomorrow, Foodland CEO Janai Wong will be with us to talk about the Give Aloha program and its role in the community.
Plus, musician Hideki Amaya will be in studio with his vihuela and baroque guitar, sharing sacred treasures from Spain and the New World. We'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line. Here's the number, 792-8217. Email us, talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Comments on Facebook Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or want to hear a past show, all our shows are archived on the Conversation page, along with links to more information about guests for each of those shows' topics discussed. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Bill Sage.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Meet us in the morning for more of the Conversation.